You're listening to the Limitless Podcast. Between this week, I'm talking to Jason Carter. Isn't that a character from a comic book? Or a movie? No, that's John Carter. Right, anyway, I met Jason via the blog, and he's been participating in Dave O'Shaughnessy events for a number of months now. Somehow prompted by the last event, or on the last event, to reach out. I don't know how much I should say about the how and the why of that. Maybe we'll just find out as we go. It's a feeling of empathy, let's say. I just felt a kind of strong resonance on the last meeting with you, so I just thought it would be worth exploring to see what's there. And of course, I'm doing these blog posts, or have been doing these blog posts, and then also the podcast, as far as exploring the day phenomenon, such as it is. So, if there's any purpose of today, that's it, essentially. Get to know each other a bit better and compare notes about Dave, what's happening with Dave. So, if you're okay with being a little bit formal, I guess we could just start there. Like, how did you hear about Dave, and how did you start participating, and how's it going so far?
Sure, I guess I heard about Dave through you, and I don't know if it was an article or a blog post. Don't know if it really matters one way or the other. I listened to you very shortly before you started mentioning to Dave, because I started listening to your stuff probably last spring, I would say. And the first thing I listened to you was the interview you had with a woman. I don't remember her name, but it was she had been abused, you know, and I think you had a two-part interview for her. And she'd been abused quite a bit when she was younger. Was it Tracy Holt? Is that her name? Tracy Hall, something like that.
No, that's not ringing a bell. But how did you come across that conversation?
I think I heard about you. You know, I was listening. I've been following James Kunstler probably about... Well, I mean, I've been following his blog post probably for about 3 years, but I read some of his books, you know, maybe a decade ago. Because I've always been interested, not always, but probably for the last 20 years, I've been interested in the peak oil scene and, you know, how that might affect the future. And so I heard about you from him. And you were also on Skeptico, which is another website that I like to, another podcast I like to listen to. And I don't remember exactly what you talked about, but, you know, between the two, just your book, I guess you were promoting it, but just between the two of you, there was something that I liked, I don't know, about the way you were talking or how you were. So I went on your blog and, just checked out that. That was probably the one that was the most current, interview that you did. And just your style of dealing with her. So I wasn't condescending in any way. It wasn't like over caring. It seemed very, you know, honest and like really didn't have any agenda. And she seemed very comfortable with you. And so, I mean, it's very hard to come across people when you listen to a lot of blog posts that don't seem like they have an agenda, you know? They're not trying to promote something. Their egos don't get in the way too much. With you, I just felt that like that was it. And so then I followed a few of your you know, weekly podcasts. And at some point you mentioned Dave. And by that time, you know, I'd already kind of felt like you're an honest guy. You know, you'd been through a lot. You'd been searching for a while for something. You mentioned that you had a false guru. I don't know if he was false, but somebody who maybe wasn't all that he appeared to be at first.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Dave, you didn't have that experience. You felt like he was like a real authentic person. And I thought, you know, I've always been a little bit interested in metaphysical, spiritual, especially as I'm getting older, more spiritual than science. I mean, I've come from a strong science background, but I've always had a bit affinity for also the paranormal. Not that I want to believe everything that I'm told, but just seems more mysterious, something exciting, something different, you know, than science, which is just, you know, pretty nuts and bolts stuff. And so I thought, well, this is a good way for me to just, you know, dip my toe into having an experiential, you know, experience rather than just reading about it and getting a concept about it and talking about it, because it's only certain much things you can talk about. If you don't experience something, you can hear people talking about it, but you really don't know what they're talking about, you know. Like, if you were to, Dave uses cooking a lot, so if you were to never have tasted, you know, I don't know, a carrot or something, and you heard people talking about carrots, you wouldn't be able to have any way of knowing what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So with Dave, I thought that was a good way to just start and see what it was about. And probably took me, I don't know, if I was to guess, maybe 3 or 4 weeks to, you know, get the courage to just contact him and say, hey, I want to, you know, sit through one of your sessions and see how that is.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, you know, I did get an immediate something out of it. I don't know, you know, a lot of that is you build yourself up to wanting to have an experience.
Do you remember which was the first Dave event?
I remember he talked about the Tower of Babel. So it was in that time frame, probably in August last summer, sometime around August.
Huh.
Yeah. And yeah, I remember just feeling afterwards, like I used the word surreal with him when I emailed him. It just felt a little surreal afterwards, walking around, almost kind of dreamlike, you know. And that was my first kind of experience. So I thought, well, it might just be me, you know, wanting something to happen, but it could be real too. So I might as well stick with it and see what happens. And then I did a one-on-one with Dave maybe a month after that. I'm not sure the exact time frame. And then I always have a weird experience with Dave's one-on-ones where I don't feel like a whole lot of things happening while I'm talking to him, but like an hour later I get this real big rush of something. I'm not sure what he called it bliss, I guess. Listened to an interview of you and him from maybe a year ago, just to kind of refresh, you know, my memory. So he was using the term bliss at that time instead of enlightenment. And that would be a good description for what I feel after one-on-ones. And so I had a real strong feeling of that after about an hour after my first one-on-one with him, lasted throughout the day. The next few days kind of faded, but I could still kind of dip into that feeling if I wanted to. And then kind of just really settled down to like a low, like a presence that's there. And now, you know, it's there when I want it, but sometimes it takes some work to get into that and experience it. But so for me, that's what I'm getting out of his. I haven't been on a retreat yet. I haven't met him in person. I don't know what the difference will be. But for me, just that euphoria that I can have access to, I think to me that's something different that I didn't have before. So that shows me that something's happening. Not quite sure what is going on behind, you know, behind the scenes, behind the consciousness. Because he seems to talk about things that might be happening without my awareness or other participants' awareness. And so when you talk about that, you're just, you know, you got to go on somebody else's, you have to trust them because you don't have awareness of it. So... yeah, it's been almost a year now that I've been seeing him, and disappointed that I didn't get to go to a retreat. I was kind of looking forward to it, but
You were planning to
world
come
events,
to this last one.
yeah, I was really, because I'd skipped the winter one, and I didn't even realize he was having retreats. I didn't want to do a lot of research on day before I met him, because I wanted to go in as objective as possible. So I wasn't even aware he was having retreats. I think I sat through like four or five Sunday events, and then he mentioned that it was leading up to a retreat, and I was like, "What? What is this all about?" And so then, I didn't really have time to plan for the one in the winter last year, and I had some other issues going on in my life that would have made it really difficult to do. So I was just kind of delayed it for this summer, and was looking forward to that, if nothing else, at least for an ex you know, just an experiment to see what was going to happen there. But then the virus hit and things got delayed, and so I don't know what's going to happen next. He was talking about for a while there that they might be ending. He was getting a feeling about that, so I don't know if there will be any in the future to go to. I hope so, but who knows?
I know, actually, it just occurred to me today that planning is not the word, we're hoping, having been planning before all of this began, to move to Europe and to set up a retreat center, I mean, a place to live and a sort of community kind of space, but specifically for the idea of the income would be the retreat, and so that could dovetail with what Dave does, of course, but it's possible. Occurred to me, it's possible that retreats might become illegal in future, as in gathering that many people. And then on the other side of things, the thrift store I run here, well, so far so good, but the ones in Vancouver, I don't know how it is in Seattle, and not just thrift stores, but modern new clothes stores. They're implementing new rules where if you try something on, it has to, and don't buy it, then that has to be quarantined for 72 hours, and all kind, I mean, things that just would make it almost impossible for us to run the thrift store. So, things are up in the air, in all kinds of ways there. Dave was talking about the last retreat some years ago. So it's something that's recurred, and needless to say, it didn't happen those years ago, and it was never clear to anyone, as far as I know, possibly not even Dave, what he meant, why. I suspect it was just a feeling or a sense he had, and so I assume the same this time, when he was saying this might be the last retreat before the thing here, the contraction. The corona contraction, as Kunstler calls it, and of course now it is in a large context that does throw everything into question and doubt, so far as the future of what Dave is doing, along with just about everything else. So, yeah, you came at an interesting time in that regard.
I wasn't expecting the, things to start to fall apart in society for another decade. I figured somewhere around 2030, just based off of peak oil, and not really fall apart, but things would change, contract. Since they're doing it anyway now, though, this might just be the kickstart. A new phase, things are changing. This, I think history goes through periods, right? Like this. It's funny, I just started reading War and Peace probably a couple of days, about 3 days
I
ago
came
and
into the
whatnot.
thrift store a few days ago and I put it out on the shelf.
Oh, really? And then in his term, the French, was it Jacobinism or something like that, with the French Revolution. And then all of a sudden, I was reading Kunstler's blog post, and he never used that term before, but he must have mentioned it four or five times in his last blog post.
Jacobianism, maybe, because I know
Yeah, that's
Jacobean
it.
is a key thing.
So it's funny how things synchronize up. And maybe we're going to be going through a different type of revolution here, but revolution nonetheless. And 10, 20 years, society will be a different, a little bit different.
Or a lot different. It's already a little bit different.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think humans were made to go around in masks. there are social animals. We are social animals. So if we can be forced to do it, then but it's going to be hard to control long term. It's just so uncomfortable. I was talking to my wife the last time I could think of anything that I've lived through, and it's not even comparable in scale, but it's similar a little bit, is when they started making people wear seat belts in cars. I remember we used to not wear seatbelts anywhere, and then when we first started to have to do it, it felt so constricting, felt so foreign than to use it, and now it's like you wouldn't think about driving around without one. So I don't know if masks will be ever that common.
Bicycle helmets is another thing.
I still haven't gotten used to that, but I don't ride bicycles too much.
Yeah, I would still, I can never imagine wearing them, but most people seem to have adjusted. And
yeah, same way with skiing. I know my there's a lot of skiers now wear helmets, and I don't ski too much. I grew up out in the desert, so there wasn't a lot of snow, but I have learned how to ski over my lifetime, and not very good at it, but yeah, wearing helmets, I'm not sure about that. I mean, there's a balance between safety and freedom. I mean, you can be super safe and not get anything ever done or have any experiences.
Yeah.
Or you can flame out, right? Be really having a lot of extensive experiences and risk your life.
Yeah.
So somewhere you got to find some kind of a balance. And I guess experience tells you, you know, where that balance is or where you need it. Unfortunately, society isn't adaptable to individuals so much.
No.
The blanket laws, the blanket rules are there to protect. It always seems to protect the most, you know, maybe the people that seem to be needed the most, whereas other people, it kind of constricts their freedom too much. So that's always hard to balance.
Well, I think that is the tension, isn't it? The safety and freedom thing is that what are we willing to give up? What kind of freedoms are we willing to give up for safety or the illusion of safety? So, because specifically with this mask wearing business, I mean, we're running the thrift store still, and some people come in masks and they talk about the situation as if they feel that they're in danger. Somebody even complained a little bit today about there's no social distancing in our store. It was a particularly busy day, so it was actually teeming with bodies, right? Physical contact, never mind social distancing. I mean, obviously that could be a problem for us in future, but my feeling around this is, well, as life is risk, you know, there's always risk in life, and if viruses are a real thing, I don't even know, but there's definitely always a risk of getting sick and, you know, overexposure to contaminants, and, you know, there's so many different levels to that because of the technology and the 5G, like the world we live in is a hazardous world, and it hasn't got less so since we left the jungle. In some ways, it's got more so. So, and I've definitely erred on the side of freedom in your model there, as you know, if you've picked up on my life story. I spent decades like taking all these risks, and so to a certain extent I've sowed my wild oats in that particular way, not in the conventional way, but in that particular way I feel like I've really pushed the bar, and I'm ready to be a little more cautious now in my middle age. But around this particularly, it just seems to me that the virus, whatever, just represents death and the risk of death, and that's something that is always there and always present, and it's impossible to actually avoid. We can't plan our days to avoid death. One way or another, it might catch us by surprise. So I don't personally feel like I'm willing to sacrifice many or any freedoms in this current situation in order to be safer. But we're in a collective, right? We're in a collective dynamic, so definitely there's a struggle there around that, which is political and all the rest of it. I mean, to me, like what you're talking about there in terms of society and where it's heading, to me, the context that it's in is similar to the context I think Dave is putting it in, or at least he doesn't talk much about the COVID itself, but he has been talking about us being on the brink of self-destruction for at least a couple of years. And that's what I've felt for since my early 20s. But I always felt that it was not necessarily a bad thing, like the destruction of humanity, or at least the destruction of civilization or the collapse of it, and the destruction of a large portion of humanity through natural causes or not. I don't know. It never felt to me like a bad thing, and obviously I was aware that if it started happening it would be horrible, but I mean, you know, from the larger perspective. And so I still feel that way. I still feel, well, I'm not entirely sure that, you know, what I want out of this anyway. I mean, I know I've got plans that I hope I can continue, but the context that Dave is working in seems to me is a transcendental one, and it's, as you were saying earlier, he refers to things that we don't perceive necessarily through our senses, or because we're not tuned into our senses, we don't perceive them mentally. And I don't know how much you've picked up of him talking about this on the online things, because I remember it more on the retreats. But he's also talked about parallel dimensions that we exist in, and that it's possible for us to become aware of existing in another dimension, different from or parallel to this one. I mean, they're obviously quite big concepts, and they can be quite confusing, but the overall sense I get with the Dave project is that we are being, or I am being corralled into a position where I will be able to let go of all of my survival concerns, including my ego survival, you know, my sense of self, and a full letting go, and then, you know, I can't articulate what happens there because it hasn't happened, but so in a sense I see all of this apocalyptic context potentially as a as an opportunity for me to let go of everything in time, you know, while I'm still here in this life.
I guess the tricky part will be the coordination of that. Like, if society does fall apart, let's be hypothetical, it would be nice if everybody fell apart at the same time. I think people who go and have their lives fall apart, their jobs, their careers, everything, while everybody around them, not everybody, but let's say half the people around them continue on normal, that's going to be pretty tough on the people, you know, that are struggling. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you're comparing, at least I think, I don't know, I didn't leave through Russia's fall, that it seemed like their whole society kind of went down at once. And I think in America, I could see a scenario where just slowly people fall to the wayside, you know, here and there and there and there and there, but there's still kind of a core that's functioning. And so you're still going to have the media, the songs, you know, everything that you get information from, you're still going to see kind of things happening normal, but then your life is completely wrecked. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think to me that's really tough. Whereas if everybody was in it, you know, they use the term here in America, we're all in it together. I wish we were, but if everybody was all in it together, it'd be a lot easier to get through, I think, for everybody than mm-hmm. just piece by piece.
Well, we do. I mean, there are people experiencing that already, and there always have been, and that's something that working in the thrift store has helped. I mean, because I was destitute for a period, so I actually volunteered. That's another reason why I think I'm better prepared than average for what's happening now, is I've already been completely destitute, so I know that it's okay, you know, it can be done. But currently I'm better positioned than I've ever been financially, emotionally, psychologically, tempted to say spiritually, communally, the feeling of being connected to community, both here where I live and online with Dave and my own work. So I really feel very well rooted in this life now, and I'm the most important thing in my body. And at the same time, working in the thrift store means I'm constantly seeing and even working with or helping, trying to help the people you're talking about, the people who, for them, either life is falling apart or it never came together. I mean, they're just the derelicts, the drug addicts, the homeless, the thieves, you know, just the real, the dregs of society. And some of them are. They do seem like loving people and quite open-hearted and just, you know, very broken, but not in a bitter, twisted way. They're definitely not the worst kinds of people. I mean, some of them are, but some of them are not. Some of them are closer to the other end of the spectrum. So that you're describing, that's kind of always been the case, I think.
Yeah, I guess I was going right to the Armageddon type of scenario.
Sure, but in that scenario, it's going to be bad for the people in good positions too, unless they're in high towers somewhere, because the more desperate the desperate people become, you have the zombie hordes.
Yeah, if they're still functioning. I mean, zombies move slow.
Yeah, if this, well, yeah.
They don't seem to have a lot of energy.
If they're not in total lockdown and plugged into their technology and, you know, conforming to the norm. Now, I was thinking about that. We're all in it together. Just yesterday, not even thinking about it, it was Sunday, I think. I had a very tough but quite enlightening Sunday, even though I didn't go to any of the days of Dave's four-day online thing, but I felt like I was in it anyway. And I realized that we're all in it together is simply a fact, that we're all in existence. Where else could we be, right? And we're together. And that's the level, I think, that Dave is talking about. Our true existence is part of this collective body of, I mean, not just humanity, it goes beyond humanity, but I think humanity is clearly where we identify and where we can really start to experience, you know, our reality or our meaning.
Self-reflect.
Yeah.
Humans are the only animals that I know of that can have that ability to self-reflect. I mean, I guess certain animals do for different levels, but not anywhere near what we do. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. It seems good, you know. That's the only reason we can talk to each other. It definitely causes problems, fantasies, suffering, as you would say. I mean, you can see a dog, and I have dogs. I know you're a cat person.
Mm-hmm.
I have dogs at home.
Yeah.
And I don't think they cause any self-suffering. I mean, they can be lonely when you leave them, and I guess they're suffering in their own way there. But I don't think that they go around. It's not true, though. I guess it's just such a low level that you don't think that they create a lot of suffering for themselves.
What do you notice with your dogs, that they feel sad if you're sad?
Probably. Depends on how sad I am. they definitely, if I'm mad, you know, they know when I'm mad. They know to leave me alone a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think they'll come over if I settle down after I've gotten angry a little bit and try to. So they feel the emotions of you, and they play off of that a little bit. But, I mean, it doesn't linger with them, right? If they were sad because I was sad, but then they saw a rabbit or something, you know, they would forget all about me and just go off and chase the rabbit or whatever they like to do.
Sure, they don't create stories out of it.
They don't stay in a mood like we would for, you know, weeks at a time.
Well, I don't think we would either if we hadn't been so intensely imprinted or impacted by overwhelming events that generated emotions that were so impossible to process that they just got pushed down into the body. And so now, as adults, every time we get triggered, every time something happens, that it does that whole reservoir of feeling, and the danger is we create a whole story in the present to account for those powerful feelings, and then we can just perpetuate the misery. Right. Or we can go all the way, let ourselves go all the way into the horrible feelings, but and then it does dispel, or it releases. But I think the nub there is whether we create a story, and then believe the story. You know, like, this is happening because my wife, you know, didn't come home when she said she would, and oh my God, my whole marriage is falling apart, whatever. Speaking personally there somewhat, rather than recognizing that that's an abandonment trauma. Those feelings of abandonment come from childhood, and they're just in the body, you know, they're just massive affect. So animals don't do that, do they? They don't hold on to stuff.
I would say no, but then again, if you've ever seen a dog that's been abused quite a bit when he's younger, they seem to be in a state of perpetual fear, mistrust.
Yeah.
Must be miserable for them. I've never seen one personally, but you know, from watching TV of rescue animals, and the animals are just in terrible conditions.
Yeah, true. Especially dogs. Dogs seem to be particularly programmable or, you know, traumatizable.
Yeah, I've never had another pet. I don't know what fish are feeling, so I guess birds can be kind of emotional. But cats as well. But cats, I don't know if you can traumatize a cat. It seems like they would just run off. They're very...
They remember. And they do, they close down a little bit, or maybe more than a little bit. But it's not the same as a dog, like you said. Dog gets cowed, it becomes a whole different personality. But, you know, dogs and humans co-evolve together. So there's some symbiotic kind of relationship there with humans and dogs, I think.
Yeah, I think their emotional part of them is very well developed to match us.
Yeah, because they wouldn't exist without humans, would they? They'd be wolves. They'd still be wolves.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, in Chernobyl, they have wild dogs roaming around, and but they still, you know, they still. It's been what, I don't know how many generations of dogs have gone through since the Chernobyl disaster. That happened in the 80s, was it? So
yeah.
Probably 35 years ago, so let's say 10 generations of dogs, but they're still, you know, they still come up to humans, even, you know, to come get food and whatnot. They haven't gotten completely
sure, because they're
isolated, they're
genetically dogs, right? They have, they're part of an ancestral line that was bred, like sheep also didn't exist, I don't think, until humans bred them. I think they turned goats into sheep, I think. Very Christian of us.
Well, at least some bachelors did a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a tendency to like to do stuff like that, don't we?
Yeah.
So.
Trying to get away from me. ended up anywhere near here. Are you trying to get away from me? Are you trying to get away from me? It's all part of the means to
Let's go back to Dave and this feeling of bliss, because that's a big takeaway. I mean, I wouldn't say in my 10 years of Dave, what is it? Is it 10 years now? No, it's 13 years since I met him, but 10 years since I started going to the retreats. I mean, I suppose on the first retreat, I did start to tune into what I think you're talking about, or what the equivalent of is for me of that is just this baseline of profound well-being. I say in the body, but it's not necessarily located in the body, but I'm experiencing it in my body, definitely not in my mind or in my emotions. It's primarily in the body, and after the retreats, there would be the feeling of, oh, that's it, you know, it's there now, I'll never lose it, kind of thing, or I don't ever need to lose it, and then it would fade over time. So I'm not sure that I would ever feel confident in saying, oh, well, I can access it any time, but I do know that for sure I just feel more well-being in my body now, far more than I did 10 years ago, and so there's been an accumulative thing. But anyway, my point was, is it was quite hard for me to have that experience, even you know, hanging out with Dave and going to the events and things. It took quite a while, whereas it seems as though you had it quite quickly.
Well, not to I know a little bit about your history, and you've used some mind altering drugs in the past, right?
I have.
So that might have desensitized you a little bit, whereas I.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I mean, I use alcohol, but other than that, you know, marijuana less than a handful of times maybe in my life. So maybe I'm just, you know, more of an open, sensitive guy in that regard, because I haven't had anything too extreme to compare it to. Just theorizing here. But I don't know. What I experienced may not even be what you're thinking of. Best way I can describe it is, if you've ever gone on a long run, I used to run a lot. And then after, if you do like a 10, 12-mile run, and then it's a real hard run, afterwards you sit down and you just have that euphoria, you know, about you, and you can feel it in your body, and you can kind of feel the heat coming off. And so that's very similar to what I feel, except without the exhausted, you know, without the exhaustion. It's just, you know, like right now I can kind of tune into it. It's not something I ever felt before, so I'm not sure what causes it. You know, I don't even know if that's what, you know, what everybody else experiences or
sure.
anything like that.
Sure, but is there a sensation associated with it?
Yeah, I would say you kind of a vibration. I always thought the New Age the crowd, I didn't like, because I'm a scientist guy, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like them when they talked about vibrating, and they, I feel like they were using the terms wrongly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I know what they're talking about now. I mean, I can definitely feel like tingling vibration type of a sensation in my body. I've meditated a bit in the past. I always, for some reason, I don't stick with it, but I'll do it every once in a while. And then I can get to a point where my whole body, you know, starts to vibrate a bit, almost like you're going to pop out of your body. And I guess they'll call it go into the astral plane. So you get that real vibration feeling. And I always get a little bit probably scared, and my own fear probably keeps me from actually going the whole way. And I come back, but it's kind of similar to that as well. I mean, it's just really a vibration that I'm feeling, and it feels good. You know, it's not like an irritating thing. It's, you know, actually like a nice, pleasant kind of buzz that's going through your body. But as if I do stuff, you know, if I'm doing activities, things like that, then I'm not aware of it at all. And then, you know, and I'm just like the normal me walking around.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, like right now talking to you, probably we're transmitting something between each other. So it's actually pretty strong. So that's the best way I can describe it. I don't have any like messages from it. I don't know what it means.
Well, that was my next question, actually. Do you feel that it has a... do you feel that it guides you?
Not really. I don't, like... No, I mean... I don't know. I mean, it's not like when I'm watching TV, all of a sudden I'll feel it, and then I can like say, oh, this is something important, need to follow, or if I get a thought... And then I notice something that kind of guides me in that way. I don't find it just correlated with anything. It's more like the sun, you know, the sun's out in the sky and you can feel it. And but it doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't really give you any information other than there's a sun out there.
Mentally, perhaps. But it's giving you vitamins and obviously warming your body and your blood and changing your state. So...
Yeah, that's true. And I think it's a calming effect for me. I'm a very sensitive, reactive person, probably quite fearful in general. And so I can, like, especially in the past, I mean, since I met Dave, maybe less so, but I always react, you know, internally, very super strong to any kind of threatful type of situation, or even what if I perceive it as threatful.
Yeah.
And I definitely am aware when that happens now, and it doesn't seem as strong, you know, it definitely doesn't feel as bad. And it's not, hopefully it'll eventually just go away. I mean, obviously if I,
your reactivity, it's interesting you put sensitive and reactive right next to each other. Cause I've noticed that people often, when they say they're sensitive, what they mean is they're reactive. Right, and of course they do often go together. If one is oversensitive, then one tends to react. But I presume you wouldn't want the sensitivity to go away, presumably, just the reactivity.
Well, like if I hear a phone ring, my body can just, you know, go into the flight or fight mode pretty quickly, and yeah, I don't like that feeling. Yeah, I wish I could like go through life and hear a phone ring and not like get all super hyped up or whatever causes that.
Yeah, what does cause it, do you think?
I don't know. I know you've talked about a lot about trauma in the past. That's kind of a thing. I wouldn't be surprised if somehow that's related. I think it's probably part genetic as well. Autism is probably related to it. My son that I have is has, he's on the spectrum, right? with Asperger's and whatnot. And at first, when he was first born, I kind of described him to myself as me, but like on steroids, you know, emotionally. I couldn't even take him to the playground in the park. And this was when he was probably 1, maybe 2 years old, without him just kind of freaking out, you know, if he saw another person out there. And he hadn't been traumatized at all that I was aware of since that. So that is all part of genetics. And I have that in me as well, where that's just kind of a genetic type of response that we have to strangers, I guess we could say, or any kind of possible interaction with a stranger. I'm not as bad as him, and I've learned how to kind of cope with it throughout my life the best I can, but it still kind of, you know, gets in my way. But it could have been maybe a reaction to trauma as well, thrown in. It's hard to separate the two, you know. Sure. Just my life history is, you know, just the fact that I was born from a natural mother. Dave talks a lot about moms and things like that, so that's why I'm going to talk about this now. And then she gave me up for adoption, I think on the day I was born, probably, or she had already planned it. Went through a couple foster homes, and then it got to my adopted parents by the time I was about 1.5 years. So, you know, who knows what that did to my development as far as trusting and security and things like that. That was before I had any language or memories or anything, so I would have no idea really how that changed me, if it did at all. Maybe it didn't have any effect. And like I said, some of this is just the genetic luck of the draw. But part of being shy, you know, really shy with people, social anxiety, things like that. Yeah, I mean, it's all tied together. So,
do people sometimes think that you're distant or aloof?
Probably aloof, arrogant. I hear sometimes people who don't like understand me too well. Usually, I'm not even just like not noticed. I'm very quiet usually, and especially like I say, if I was in a group with people I don't know very well or whatnot, I'm not going to. I mean, I could force myself to introduce myself, but I don't, you know, I don't have a lot of success talking to people about things. So I like to talk about important things, and then you're just talking, shooting the breeze, you know. But I can manage. I'm trying to analyze myself here, so it probably doesn't make a good conversation. But, yeah, I mean, I would be comfortable just being off by myself, you know, and kind of watching what's going on. But then just knowing that I'm not interacting normally makes me uncomfortable. So I prefer to avoid social interactions like that if I can.
It does sound quite Aspergerian of you.
Yeah. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, I did have friends. I mean, I wasn't a complete loner. You know, I was, grew up playing a lot of sports. Luckily, I was pretty good in school. I mean, I could excel, but I never really tried to. And so I guess in that way, I kind of fit in with society. I had my niche, you know, that I could get through life. I wasn't a complete outcast, so.
Well, you became a dentist, so that's very mainstream. Like, how did that happen? A sensitive guy.
Well, I didn't think about, you know, the day-to-day interactions with people when I chose the profession. Right. It was more like I was a little bit older student because I had been in the military, in the Air Force, actually, in the mid-80s. Hmm. And then went back to school. And usually 4 years to do a bachelor. It took me, I think, 5.5 years to get my bachelor. And then afterwards, I had a bachelor's in chemistry. I would have been happy just staying in a research lab, right, doing research, but couldn't really find a position after I got my bachelor's. So then I thought, well, I got to do something to make money. So I thought about professional school. So the big three came up was medicine, law, or business. And medicine, I thought, was too time-consuming. I was already getting married. I was in the process of getting married to my wife. I didn't want to have to go through that. And then she kind of helped me choose, you know, law. She didn't want to be married to a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought business would have been a bad match for me. So, I mean, dentistry was just kind of something that we thought about. And then the more we thought about it, we thought, well, yeah, that seems reasonable. You know, it's a four-year program. Dentists have a little bit of prestige, you know, that they're known to make a little bit of money.
It's a very useful skill as well. Like we were saying, well, if we create our intentional community, Jason can come because we'll definitely need a dentist.
Yeah, I don't know how you guys would have to have like a, I mean, it wouldn't be running off of, you know, sticks and fire. Yeah, you definitely have to have some. It's very intensive as far as equipment goes and technology.
Yeah, I know. We realized that as well. You'd have to bring your own equipment.
Yeah. So anyway, I got involved in that, and that's the way I got involved. And as far as like just, it's not that bad because kind of a role playing a lot in dentistry.
Interesting you said that, because actually that's what it's just what I was thinking about, like how it is for you attending the Dave things, and you know, so much of the focus is on what we are on the other side of our false identity before it and potentially after it if we ever attain freedom and reconnect to our life force. So yeah, my mind just went there in terms of you being a dentist. If that was part of your constructed identity, and how that's holding up in this last year or so with Dave. Do you feel that you've been in a sort of slow burn identity crisis?
I think I was before I met him. I've never been fully embraced any kind of role that like put on a persona. I've always felt like I've always been pretty true to myself. I do things that probably, you know, are habits that I've gotten growing through life, like kind of being a smart ass at times in certain situations, trying to be kind of a funny guy or a contrarian, you know, argumentative a lot with people. Those are probably bad habits. I don't think that they're the real me. But as far as, like, I always try when I meet a patient, I don't like to go off a script. I don't sell anything. I always try to be honest and try to have some kind of connection with them, you know, as best I can, and try to be authentic. And it's not great for my business, but that's just kind of the way I am. And so I don't feel like I had, like, a real fake false persona that I have to remove. I feel like, but that I could be completely deluding myself in that regard. But I've always felt kind of, you know, like this, I haven't changed much my personality throughout my life, and haven't put on airs, haven't put on, you know, I'm just thinking now through my history, if I'm being truthful to you, and that's kind of how I felt.
What about, I mean, the shy? Make it... The shyness, though, isn't that a... Not that it's putting on airs, but it's a not wanting to be seen.
Yeah, that's, I guess, self... you have a lot of... Well, I think that comes from feeling like, ooh, I'm on stage now. There's a lot of pressure on me to do something, you know, kind of mm-hmm. neat for somebody, you know, and maybe I'm not feeling like that, or, you know, I can't do that for you.
Sure.
Do you think that's learned, though, or do you think that's...
Well, yeah, I mean, I can relate to that, but if I didn't have a persona that I was trying to maintain, then I don't see how or why I would have any anxiety about not being able to deliver something I thought was expected. It's like you can't lose face if you don't have a face, you know, at least if you don't identify with it.
Yeah, but then what about the genetics of that? Like a certain shyness runs in families or whatnot. Isn't that hardwired into your genes?
I don't know genes from Levi's, really. Just be... But as you said earlier, it's not either or anyway. Like a trauma can be congenital, if that's the word, genetic, or it can be, you know, actually circumstantial, but they merge together. And the result is the same. I mean, they both contribute to the creation, the formation of a false self, I think, that needs to be defended.
Well, there's always going to have to be some self there. If you think about somebody who has completely lost their ego, has no false self, they're going to have a self there. They're still going to care, I think. They're going to care about, you know, other people.
Well, that's why I said false self. I mean, that's why Dave uses false self, I presume, although that is a blurry area. I mean, I'm not sure what his position is on that. I know he says that there's no identity where he is. He doesn't have any sense of an identity. And self is, it's just one of those words, isn't it? Like mind, even, that we kind of assume that we know what we're referring to, but actually, can we locate it? So in this context, it's specifically, and this comes back to the subject of safety and freedom, specifically it's about a self. I'd say the false self is kind of identifiable, recognizable by its need to protect itself and defend itself and maintain itself and assert itself. This was in my last blog post, my experience of perceiving existence without any of that and how liberating it is. And I think that that's the nature of the false self and what makes it false. It's not just that we have a sense of existing. We could say self in its widest sense is self-awareness, awareness that we exist. But this is specifically, or it's inseparable from what you're talking about with the phone ringing. I mean, that's a quite extreme example. Not that extreme. I've talked about the flinch. Like, I became aware over the years that whenever I see someone on the street at any distance whatsoever, there's a flinch in my body, as if I want to hide from them or turn away. So it goes very deep in us that this self that doesn't want to be seen and that feels threatened by everything, even a ringing phone. It seems to me that's not necessary for us to exist. Because it's not, as my point about safety and freedom, there's so many things that we think we need to be safe from that we don't.
I wonder if that's possible to lose completely. You know, I'm a science guy, right? And I keep harping on that a little bit. So when I see like different animals, like say you have different cats, they're going to have different personalities right from the start. Some are going to be a lot more shy than others. Some are going to be more friendly to people.
Temperament.
I think that's temperament.
That's the word I use, yeah.
But probably they're feeling what we feel, you know? The ones that don't want to come, that hide under the bed, to go in the back rooms when you have people over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're the ones who are going to stay safe in nature from danger. But they will also probably be less likely to, you know, breed or
get food even.
And get food.
Starve. Well, I think
there might be nature's strategy for just, you know, long-term species survival. You have to have different types out there.
Sure, I definitely think there are different types and different temperaments. I once asked Dave about this. I think it's more or less what you're asking. Like, do you feel fear, Dave? Do you still experience fear? And he said, well, if I'm walking on the path and a bike suddenly comes and is about to hit me, then I will feel a rush of adrenaline and get out of its way. But that's very different. I mean, there's no doubt that we, evolutionarily, if you like, because you're a science guy, we are... built in such a way that we need to be able to protect ourselves, absolutely. But, and yeah, the do seem to be, I mean, maybe it has to do with, in the animal kingdom, maybe it's just to do with weaker and smaller. Maybe it's an instinctive fear, assuming there isn't any overwhelming trauma. or let's just say trauma as trauma being something that can't be processed, right? As opposed to, you know, adverse conditions that we can process, generally in the animal kingdom, because everything is in harmony, apparently. I don't know, maybe that's an assumption, but most of the adverse conditions can be processed, and so there isn't this build-up of unprocessed tension. But there would be smaller and weaker creatures, even in a litter, so it's possible that, and they would have different temperaments, so it's possible the temperaments correspond with that. And yeah, a little bit more fear if you're weaker or smaller helps with your survival, whereas, you know, obviously too much would hinder it. So it's kind of the right dose. But clearly, as human beings, we are overdosed on fear, and even constantly, I write about this in 60 Maps of Hell, we're addicted to media that stimulates our fight-flight responses. We actually like to feel fear as entertainment, which is really bizarre, right? I mean, you can break it apart and analyze it, but on its face value, it's just really bizarre.
Well, there's a theory that the reason it's fearful is gets your attention, is because that's the fearful people throughout, you know, the history of humans are the ones that, I mean, if you do a cost analysis to benefit, the cost of being fearful isn't that great compared to the potential benefit of not getting eaten by something, you know,
right.
Versus people who perhaps ignore danger, ignore fear, and they just concentrate on beauty, you know, they're going to be less aware of predators, and they're going to be taken out of the gene pool. So, I mean, that makes sense. It's consistent. It's a good theory. I don't know if it's true or not, but it would explain why. I mean, it's sex, right? What sells? Sex and fear. It seems like to be the two big sellers out there.
Sex and violence, and, yeah.
Yeah, and violence, and that's, you know, that's all related to, you know, survival and, you know, passing your genes on to the next generation.
Well, there's the other end of the spectrum, though, which is that the fearful may survive in the way that you're saying because they keep their heads down, but the fearsome, the aggrandizers in society, who aren't exactly fearless, I don't suppose, but they push past their fears and even self-traumatize themselves, like, you know, Mexican cartel initiation rituals is an obvious example, so that they don't feel fear. They totally desensitize themselves and, you know, turn themselves into psychopaths, essentially, and they become very fearless and fearsome. Their survival also is, well, in a Mexican drug cartel, I suppose your survival rate isn't that good, but the higher up you get, the better your chances of survival are, or at least if you've got a fortress. And, you know, I guess it's both, isn't it, right? You're basically constantly under threat, but you've got the power to protect yourself and kill all your enemies. So that's, I mean, we're getting into a social analysis now, aren't we? Like, there's different ways of coping to the fear mechanism within and to the threats outside that guarantee or increase our chances of survival. And there's two ends of the spectrum there. You've got the, you know, ones who keep their head down and just stay docile and follow along, stay safe, and then you've got the ones who are just pushing for total freedom, and they mm-hmm. have to do absolutely everything to numb themselves to any kind of fear at all.
Yeah, I don't know, that might just be an outgrowth of our civilization, though. I mean, we're not talking about Dave too much, but we can get back on the subject. But just, mm-hmm. you know, if you do go back to evolution again, which I think we talked about in a few of your articles, maybe three or four ago, we talk about if we evolved in a tribe of 100 people to 200, you're going to have leaders. But if they're two, you know, if they're too cruel, if they're too psychopathic, they're too violent to their own people, they're probably not going to be in that situation. I mean, they probably will be either killed or somehow pushed out, I would imagine, because, I don't know, I'm just speculating now. I kind of feel silly doing this, but
Well, yeah, it is. As I said, it's a big social analysis, and I know we could go into all kinds of deep, dark stuff here, but as you said, it gets further and further from Dave. So the context for this was the false self, which I really think is central to trauma genesis and ritual abuse and all the things I've been mapping, is the creation of false selves and the falsification of human beings. So we know what it's like, I think, when a world gets completely overrun, body snatched really, by these trauma generated false identities. But we don't know what it's like for an organism, certainly for a collective, you know, a population of organisms, to have pushed out the false self or integrated and dissolved it, however that works, and to be existing in a, not necessarily a state of no fear, but no unnecessary fear, no neurotic fear, no anxiety around self-image, I think, is so central to it. Right?
If we go to, is there a society in history that you can point to that you found that is kind of close to that? I mean, I know our entire society is set up to push that. I mean, in America especially, if you go through the school system here, public schools, I mean, they're definitely, you know, fear-based, rule-based, image-based. You're good, you're not good, you know, you're smart, you're not smart, you're a good athlete, you're not. I mean, they're just kind of creating it, your image for you. I mean, it's not like you have a lot of choices there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to, let's say you go to the Aborigines in Australia, I mean, mm-hmm. do they have the same dynamics, but just in a little bit different? Or do they have false selves? Or are they more true to themselves without that?
In the backyard, I saw some rain falling from above, making everything in my hands turn to not enough. Thank you.
into the outback. I don't know, of course it gets romanticized as the Native Americans have been romanticized. I have noticed, and my wife has commented, that Native Americans do here in Canada do seem to have a more innate humility to them. It would be hard to separate that from the how beaten down they've been, and certainly one can't see them in their natural state. Very far from it. They've been heavily traumatized. So they're definitely not an enlightened people by any means. My time in Guatemala, I hung out with the Mayan people. Also in Morocco, I know I felt this too. There's something a little more, or maybe a lot more primal about many of the people there and about the culture that was closer to natural, but it was also more primal. Something kind of more openly violent about it too. So I'd be hesitant about suggesting that is necessarily more enlightened because of it. It's simpler and less complexified, and yeah, I think self-image is not. I mean, it's true even with poor people. Actually, I noticed this at the thrift store. Actually, the poor downtrodden people. I mean, they're cunning like rats or snakes or what have you, and they got definitely not trustworthy. Many of them, they're thieves, half of them. But they've definitely got less time and energy for pretending. And less care about image because they're already the dregs. So there is also something that's a little more authentic in there, certainly than the bourgeoisie, if you like. Anyway, that didn't really answer your question, but basically, you know, what's my experience of different people? Yeah, nothing that comes close to people in a pristine state, but that includes individuals too. I mean, this is the nub of Dave. And what draws me to Dave is, regardless of whether he's a guru or a mentor or to me, just the existence of anybody, you know, finding anybody out there who, through all the tests and the, you know, observations and the critical analysis, seems to come out with a clean bill of health, is astonishing to me. Astonishing and uplifting and inspiring, not as somebody to follow, but or even as an example to follow, though there is that element. But knowing that state is, you know, is more than possible, is natural.
Yeah. He says he doesn't like to talk about paths, right? Don't follow in his footsteps to get there.
Yeah.
So. There's no, he doesn't like talk about like processes and systems and whatnot.
Yeah.
So even though it might be possible, I don't know. I guess for me, one of the things I have with Dave, and it's probably by design on his part, is lack of instructions make it a little bit frustrating. Because we sit there, right, on Sundays for what, 3.5 hours, 4 hours sometimes. And it feels good. You know, I'm always relaxed afterwards. I always feel much more calm and whatnot. But I don't know what to do after that. You know, I just go through my life. I don't have instructions on how to progress to the next level. I mean, I guess it's organic. You know, a tree doesn't need to have instructions on how to grow.
Well, this might be your scientific bent, though. I mean, if you're expecting an actual instruction manual, because I think... And one of the things that doing the blog post helped me to maybe to see is that there are instructions in there in a general sense. They're not like methodologies or steps or formula, but they're models that can be tested and applied in terms of passing the life force from the trauma implant and the false identity and discerning, you know, ways to move and ways to flourish and ways to tune in and stay in tune with the life force, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I know what you're saying is because that's what he talks about, right? It's hard to decipher. you know, for me, it's hard to even remember exactly what he says during these. You're very good at that and writing it out. I guess I should do more rewatches that he does. But, you know, also in my history, I used to exercise a lot in the gym with weights. And there's definitely, like with weights, you can make progress the quickest by having a set schedule, keeping recordings of what's going on, knowing how much to do on a certain day, what kind of exercises to do, you know, how much to wait before you do it again, you know, your diet and all that. And that's a, you know, a good way to guide your body's going to react. That's a pretty consistent way of reacting to something. And I guess maybe if you just sat around and talked about like sports and then didn't give anybody any guidance on how to do it, I know what you're saying. I can see both sides of the coin here at the same time. So that's why it's hard to talk, because I don't like to be contradictory, and I'm already contradicting myself in my mind. But I would think, though, I mean, there's a lot of programs out there that actually do step-by-step processes to become enlightened, and they may just be money makers for the people.
Yeah.
But it seems like if we're all humans and we're kind of all similar, that if you do certain things, you have similar results.
There's energy work. So that's very methodical and step by step, and it's the same every time. It's the opposite of the rest of Dave's thing, the energy work.
And what is the purpose of the energy work? To experience, to be able to be aware of different experiences in your body, sensations?
Well, there's two levels of the energy work, maybe more, but I've only participated in two. The first is clearing out the toxins of the body. And then the second is moving with the energy, tuning into the energy, bringing in new energy, and letting the energy move you. So yeah, becoming more conscious of how the life force is in our bodies and how it can move us. Mm-hmm. Roughly, not very well articulated there, but that clearly the second level, and that's been actually physical contact, martial arts kind of moves. There's been a lot of that, or most of that has been of that kind of nature on the retreats. That's where Dave's the methodical nature of the energy work starts merging with the very chaotic, spontaneous, improvisatory nature of Dave's teachings, quote unquote, in general, with energy work level two, because although he will teach us moves that are very specific, he never gives us time to master them. We always move on to a new one, and we rarely repeat the same move on the same retreat. So we never really. I mean, I did, because I practiced some of them after the retreat. So, but generally, it's very unlikely you get to really memorize them and turn them into a formula. Now, I don't know if that's deliberate on Dave's part in terms of he doesn't want us to do that. I don't think so. I think it's just that once he's getting more into the flow of energy, then he's like a child in that regard. He just wants to keep bouncing onto the next thing. And to me, that's, and I've said this before, the most essential thing about Dave and the most compelling proof that he is in a different state, and if he's called it enlightenment, then he's enlightened, is this ability to be spontaneous and improvise and unexpected the whole time. It's just always unexpected. And I've started to see that in my own life, particularly since I've been collaborating with Dave. It's become more, I guess, more essential, this, that as soon as I start thinking I know where it's going, I also realize, oh, it's not going that way, and I'm sure enough, of course, it doesn't. There's something about the life force that can only move if it isn't, you know, pinned down, and if it isn't confined to particular channels that we've already conceptualized. I think that's really the most essential thing about what Dave is showing, is how to be spontaneous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would have been helpful for me to go to a retreat, I think. That's one of the things I was missed out on. Besides, well, just the unknown for me at this stage. You've been to quite a few, so for you it's old hat. He is very spontaneous, so I'll give him credit. For that, you never know really what he's going to talk about. I don't even think he knows what he's going to talk about sometimes.
Yeah, and on the retreat, it's interactive and dynamic. So, and I'm sure you've experienced this on the online events too. Like if you're asked to speak, it can be a little bit overwhelming because he's created a space, or we've created together, but Dave, you know, is leading by example, in which there is the opportunity to move spontaneously and speak spontaneously. It's not enforced, but this is why I asked earlier if you felt that this life force was, or this feeling of euphoria guided you, because my sense is that as we start to tune into that feeling, it comes and goes or in intensity according to how free we can be. But it really needs us to be free and loose and flowing and spontaneous and unpredictable in order to just carry on moving. And so that's what I find on these meetings, and it's intensified, you know, 20-fold on the retreats, is that it's not just Dave being spontaneous and unexpected and surprising himself and everyone else, but it's us as well. So then as soon as there's an opening, there's a feeling of, okay, what's going to come out of me now, and can I let it come out? And this tension between if I force it, then it won't just flow out and be this spontaneous expression, because I'll be using my mind to you know, mold something before I deliver it. But if I wait too long, if I inhibit that usual way of being, then I might just freeze. It's like, what's the space between fight, flight, and freeze, I guess? Well, there's all these F's, but flow would be the F that space is for. And so on the retreats, yeah, it gets very, very interactive and very amazing. I mean, I could say terrifying if I wanted to, you know, give a dark spin for it. It's not really, but potentially, if one is very attached to one's identity, and one well, it is frightening to start to express and move in ways that aren't being confined and directed by that identity. Absolutely not knowing what's going to come out, or if we'll have anything to come out, you know, anything to give. It's like you were to get up on stage in Wembley Stadium, having sold thousands of tickets, and you actually had no idea what all those people were there for. You know, it's kind of like that, you know, 'cause but it isn't the audience for me. It's me and something else. Like this. There's a sense that there's this amazing potential for an experience of something now, and I can miss it. I mean, it's happening right now. I'm trying to articulate in a way that's actually gets to what I'm saying, but as long as my mind keeps going in there, then I keep losing it. But it's in everything, every conversation, every move that we make. But on the retreat, it gets concentrated into this. You know, like the sunlight through a magnifying glass, until one can feel the intense pressure of the opportunity of each instant, and how spontaneity is the only thing that will you know, meet that potential.
He's also Dave's a bit different with having these retreats twice a year. And they're limited to a week, I believe. Although
Seven
he said
days.
In the past they used to be longer.
Not in my experience.
But what is keeping him from just having like a commune, you know, full time?
We did discuss it.
So, Yeah.
We did discuss it. I mean, you're a smart guy. You don't have to be science minded to know that getting a bunch of people together to live together in harmony was, you know, the basically the most difficult challenge that has never we've never managed it yet, really.
But if he spends a week getting everybody in tune, just to release them, seems like he does all the hard work all the time, and then when it becomes easy, yeah, it's like, let's release them.
That was exactly my point when we were talking about creating a community, and that was Dave's feeling too, that you're just all ready to really start living together in harmony, and it's over. You got to leave and go back to your life, absolutely. Or you know, somewhere in between these two ends of the spectrum, it could be, you know, month-long retreats would seem to really optimize. But of course, it's what's possible. I mean, like now, it's only possible even to have them on Zoom. So, I'm not sure if that's the way it's going. I hope so. This is my hope, was to just move to Europe and set up a space where we can do these things with or without Dave, hopefully with, and that will be, you know, the future, what there is of it, the future of humanity, I think, is only going to be in intentional communities that are intending something beyond this world. It sounds very highfalutin, I know, but call a spade a spade. I mean, we are headed for eternity. There's no way of circumnavigating that fact, death. So that's the problem in a nutshell, I think, is, yeah, you can get people harmonized in their focus and their intent in 7 days on the transmission, if you like, or on the truth, or on their souls. But could you sustain it if they were if it became an ordinary living together as well, like, because you couldn't just constantly be, if it was a permanent thing, then people would have to cook, they'd have to, I mean, there's so much that has to be done to maintain a community like that. So would those individuals be able to stay harmonized? This is where monasteries, how they function, all the monks live together, and the enmeshment and the social tensions that occur in most, you know, in any family, never mind a community, are reduced because the monks are not focusing on each other, they're focusing on the divine. They've given up their lives to God, and they've got this faith thing. Well, Dave doesn't offer that kind of faith, right? It's much more individual oriented, customized, and more based on autonomy and freedom. It's been an enormous challenge. I mean, I'm up for the challenge, because nothing else more worthwhile, in my opinion. It has to be the right people and the right time and the right place.
That's true, and it would be, you know, a good learning experience, even if it failed. I mean, yeah. But you look through history, right, of all the failed hippie kind of stuff. I mean, there was a guy in Oregon, what was his name, Ramesh?
Rajneesh.
Yeah, but yeah. Theirs was not quite set up on the same values as what you're talking about. It seemed like it was, you know, a little bit corrupt right from the beginning.
Yeah,
That's very hard to get rid of when you have people coming together. You don't really know 100%
absolutely
what their agendas are.
Absolutely, yeah. And that thing was huge in Oregon. It was hundreds of people, if not thousands.
Yeah, and I don't even know at this point in history if there's a country that would even put up with that, you know, without trying to intervene in some way with their government.
Well, if it grew into a town or something, but as far as having an intentional community that's geared towards zero carbon footprint, to creating providing, planting trees, for example, growing produce, those things are useful to the state, those kind of communities.
you would have to have some interaction, right, with the surrounding communities around you as well.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be completely isolated. I'm sure you've thought quite a bit of this, and I'm just now starting to think about it. So, yeah, that would be, you know, let me know when you get that all planned up.
Okay.
Give me a ring, and then I'll probably come and visit and say, yeah, it's working out pretty well. Yeah, you know. Problem with me is I have, you know, family. I don't know. Dave, does he have children? Do you know? I don't know anything personal about him, really. So I'm always curious about, once you have a child, you know, the dynamics are going to be a lot different. When you look at through history, if you look at Jesus Christ, right, or the Buddha, or was it Krishna, the Hindu?
Mm-hmm.
I believe they all were single guys, were they not? Or were they family, and then some of them left their families, and then...
Well, there are different theories about Jesus. Krishna had sex with thousands of women simultaneously, but I guess that was after he was a god. I'm not sure of his story arc. Buddha, Siddhartha... I actually don't know either. I mean, I know he was a prince, and he was an ordinary guy before he got enlightened. But I don't know if he was married before he got enlightened. I suspect not. But anyway, these are myths more than historical figures, aren't they? I mean, they may be both, but they've definitely been mythologized.
Yeah, but I think most people in the world, I mean, it would be nice to have I hate to use the word guru, but a guru is just like a normal family man.
Yeah.
Who has to deal with all the normal family stuff that everybody else has to deal with.
Yeah.
And still able to maintain, you know, whatever makes them special. And then, of course, you know, their kids, how are they going to discipline their children? How are they going? Because the children at some point are going to want to rebel. You know, how all that works out. So I'm sure there's some kind of comedy movie or something in there somehow.
Well, that was
it would be very much difficult, to maintain your calmness, your enlightenment, and everything.
Sure, but that's. I mean, I feel like we didn't have kids, and not by choice. We missed that particular boat. But I do feel that being married is inseparable from my, my process the last 10 years, and as effective as it's been in terms of loosening up the fascia and reaccessing my life force and just becoming at peace in my body and in my life, that it's impossible to separate Dave's influence from that of my wife. And then it's not even their influence, but it's a symbiosis. The symbiosis obviously occurs in a marriage, but it also does in a very close working relationship such as I've had with Dave. And they've proceeded in tandem, but anyway, the point here for me is that the hardships of marriage, to me, and I agree that it's almost a deal breaker that a spiritual teacher is walking a walk that is consistent with ordinary human existence at its hardest, which is marriage and kids, in my opinion. And that was my point for me, that it's definitely that kind of hardship, the kind of tests and challenges that being married or being a parent present to us, I think, are unparalleled on the so-called spiritual path. It's not a path, but you know what I'm saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
The opportunities to see our weaknesses and our blind spots, and to let go of our defenses and our ego. And of course, many marriages don't achieve that potential. They either don't work out, or they settle into some kind of complacency. I feel very blessed in that regard, because my marriage, the relationship I'm in, has done neither, actually. It almost did destroy itself, but we managed to survive by the skin of our teeth. That was part of the early retreats, was seeing Dave interacting with his family, and also after retreats going to one-to-one sometimes. I'd hang out with him and his family. To me, that was essential, and it wasn't just curiosity of wanting to see behind the scenes. It was wanting to see, is Dave consistent Because it's it really, how much easier is it to be the enlightened guy if you're surrounded by people who think you're the enlightened guy? You know, even I've tried that, and it worked out for a while. I didn't ever say I was enlightened, but I kind of acted like a guru in my own group for a while, and it's amazing how much power and confidence it gives a person. So yeah, the real acid test is, as I found out with John DeRuiter, well, what do his partners say about him? They've got a whole different story, tale to tell, and he did keep that concealed, and Dave hasn't. He doesn't. And from what I saw, he was consistent. He was consistently the way he was, you know, whether he was just hanging out in a restaurant or whether he was full on spiritual teacher man. Obviously, it was different levels of intensity, but his way of being was the same.
I was thinking of the enlightened people that have a lot of affairs. I'm not sure that's that can mix well, because I don't know. It seems like if you become enlightened, since we're using this word quite a bit now, I might as well just keep with it. And then, I mean, I don't know how that affects your sex drive, and if it does affect your sex drive, but if you have one woman, I mean, I don't know. I would think a lot of sex is not just you wanting to have sex, but somebody wanting to, you know, be with you. It's a little bit of an ego trip. And if you're enlightened, you're supposed to be beyond that. So to have an affairs and a bunch of affairs, it seems like you're just, you know, you still got a ego there that you're trying to serve. And I don't know, what would be your opinion as far as just on that one aspect, as far as if you're enlightened, do you feel like if you're even a bachelor, but you're having a lot of sex with different women, is that just, you know, part of being natural and going with the flow, or is that like a little defect in you?
Well, I know the rationale for it. It's an interesting question because just a few days ago, I thought about asking Dave to do a podcast about sex, or about the time I blog posted about my penis and my sex life, with great reluctance, as you know. But I seemed to go all right. I feel it was successful, the experiment. Anyway, around that time, I thought, oh, I wonder if Dave would be willing to do a podcast and just talk about sex and how he is with sex. And so it's timely that you bring it up now, because I haven't. He doesn't talk about his sex life, understandably, and I haven't really asked him about it, because on a one-to-one, I'm talking about me most of the time and my sex life. But this question that you're raising is obviously very central to John DeRuiter and what I discovered about him. Having all these different lovers, partners, concubines, whatever we're going to call them, a harem, really. There's another guy called Bernie Pryor, or B. Pryor, who, Venetia, who's been on this podcast, she follows him as well as Dave. And, you know, I've listened to him, and I'm pretty much like him. He seems pretty good. But he does this polymorphous thing. And I know that his reasoning for it is roughly, it's not a million miles from John DeRuiter's. It's the calling. It's a way for him to share his, you know, enlightened essence with as many people as possible, and increase the field and all that.
Sure.
I'm of course right. So I'm skeptical about that, for more ways than one. One, the obvious, that's making you laugh. The other, what you're asking about, like what. Why would somebody who is enlightened need more than one partner? That's the question I have. And unless you introduce this polymorphous idea that an enlightened being like Krishna's got so much life force that he wants to share it freely with as many women as want it, you know. And I'm not ruling that out, but the thing that I learned the hard way in marriage is that there's nothing harder for the male ego than to be with one woman who who won't give him, I should say me, but I really feel that this has got to be quite a universal thing, that being with one woman that I loved and desired, and because things have got rocky, she wasn't available to me sexually. And mm-hmm. and all the insecurity and the mother issues and the trauma that brought up, and the stronger and stronger need just to have that validation of that she loved me and that she wanted me sexually, and the more I wanted it, the more desperate I was, the further I pushed her away, and the angrier I got. It was just this hideous nightmare cycle of pain and recrimination and resentment that eventually, as I said, the marriage almost self-combusted, and I fled. I just had to leave. I'm out of here. This was congruent with when I first started getting involved with Dave turning to him to help me was as the marriage was coming unraveled, which was also congruent with me finding out about John DeRuiter and all this. So it was a perfect storm. And at the center of it was this question of because one of the easiest go-to for me in that situation was, oh, I'll just go and have sex with somebody else. I'll show her that way, and I'll get what I need from somebody else. That seemed like the one way I could, the one action where I could really, because I couldn't force my wife without mm-hmm. making it worse. Celibacy, involuntary celibacy was just hell on earth. I'll just find another woman, have sex with her and tell her about it, and fine, well, that's what you get, It seemed like that would just fix everything in a way. I'd get my sexual needs met, I'd show her, right? So then I started to look at John DeRuiter and his thing, because his wife wasn't having sex with him when he started going openly polyamorous, I think. I'm not entirely sure about that. Probably should retract that, but certainly he'd been married many, many years, he's had kids. Clearly she didn't worship him. Clearly it was a difficult, strained marriage, and he started, I don't know when he started, but so I started to wonder, well, maybe that's the acid test of enlightenment, is that you can live the most ordinary life, including a kind of boring marriage where you're not even getting laid anymore, and doesn't matter, that's your partner, you stick with them, because there's something about marriage, and it's in the vows, that the real value of it is the commitment to being with one person. And I think part of that is because of how hard it is.
Mm-hmm.
It really does require letting go of our personal wants and needs, and not believing this story that we're telling ourselves. In my case, she's not giving me what I want, and I deserve what I want, and I'm going to get it no matter, And that was all fueled by hormones, which themselves were turbo boosted by trauma, and abandonment issues, attachment disorder, and the whole smorgasbord that my readers and listeners all know, a lot about. It was a massive complex. It was really the heart of me. I'm not saying it's resolved, but I am saying that being willing to just stay in there, and even when I went off to Guatemala, I never slept with anyone else. It wasn't through lack of trying. So I'm not saying that I'm a virtuous guy. I'm just saying that it was good, actually, that I went through all that. I had to let go of all of those compulsive needs to get some kind of gratification and validation and satisfaction. And at the end of it all, I came back to my wife, and partly through being on the retreat with Dave, and I realized, whatever we're here together for, it's more important than making each other happy and satisfying, emotionally gratifying each other. Let's just find out what we're here together for. And it's, there's a partnership there. And so, yeah, that's my very long-winded answer, I think. To me, I think that is an acid test of enlightenment, is a willingness to be absolutely committed to one person, and that, therefore, this polymorphous perversity somehow invalidates that.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I think it's this premature going more than human. Enlightenment isn't about being more than human, it's about being fully human. And I happen to think that we're like swans. I think that human beings mate for life. Yeah, it's not scientific. I can't give any scientific evidence for that, but.
Yeah.
I got chills that are multiplying, and I'm losing control, 'cause the power you're supplying, it's electrifying. You better shape up, 'cause I don't want a man. And my heart is set on you. You better shape up. You better understand. To my heart, I must be true. There's a love for me and you. You're the one that I want. Ooh, 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 are you the one that I want? Ooh, 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 are you the one that I want? Ooh, ooh, can't you see? Oh, yes, and affection, you're too shy to convey. Meditate my direction, baby. Feel your way. You better shape up, 'cause there is no man who can keep me satisfied. You better shape up. You better prove that my faith is justified. I know down deep inside I'm the one that you want.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I mean, it feels like the right thing for me as well. I've never had an urge to like cheat or stray. I definitely have had problems in my marriage, as everybody has, and some pretty big ones. But you're right. I mean, there's a commitment there. I think you have to be committed, and it's too easy just to as things get rocky, just to go away, you know, to separate and go your own way. And you learn a lot from sticking it out. I guess that's another thing, and it's not just about marriage, but with anything you do, if things aren't working out well, you have to at some point say, well, you know, I'm learning something here, even though things aren't going well, I have to stick it out. And then when I come back the other end, I'm going to be a better person. I'm going to learn a lot. I'm going to have a lot of lessons. But if you're going down a dead end, you know, at some point you got to know when to either turn around and go back the other way or hold a parachute, or those are hard decisions to make in life because you don't know the future. So I'm glad it worked out for you, but you're still young. Another 20, 30 years of marriage. We'll see if you still feel the same way.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah, it's 10.
It changes, though, you know.
12.
Marriages change over time. What your experience when you've been married for 25 years is different than what you experience at the year 10.
You've been 25 years then?
Almost.
Yeah.
Next year it'll be 25.
Wow.
Yeah. Long time, huh?
Well, yeah, it's a long time for commitment and, as you say, no straying. You're probably a pretty rare case now for your generation, for our generation.
That's
probably pretty rare, I'd say, because our culture doesn't encourage that kind of... It's sacrifice, right? There's an element of sacrifice.
Yeah, I know you grew up in England, I grew up in America, but we're in the same generation, Generation X. A lot of us grew up with dysfunctional parents, though, because they were the baby boomers, right? Or the, even maybe a little bit before, or right at the beginning of that. So they went through the 60s, the drugs, and they went through the women's libs in the 70s, and that's when divorces and women wanted to go off on their own and start over lives. They thought they had that right, which they did, but probably wasn't great for the family. So I think a lot of our generation don't want to make that mistake that our parents made. For me, I mean, that's one of the real strong things that kept me, you know, committed into a relationship for this long so far, you know, I didn't want to put my children through that. And then also, it felt like, well, you know, I've already been through that in my history. Let's see it this way. And I don't know if a lot of Generation X is, if their divorce rate or their dysfunctional rate is lower than their parents. I don't have any stats on that, but that's just my feeling from people that I grew up with, that they're a little bit more committed to less. I don't know, maybe we were more wild growing up and we want more stability now. You know, when you grow up with too much freedom, it's probably not good for you.
Mm-hmm. So do you think I should do a podcast with Dave about sex, or rather do you think Dave should do a podcast with me about sex? Do you think that would be helpful?
I'm not sure what his viewpoints are. He talks about sex a lot. He likes to talk about the anatomy and bodily functions and defecating and vomiting and whatnot. So.
I think one of the reasons, I mean, there's the obvious reason he wouldn't want to do it, is it's so personal, but another, I think, is that there would be a tendency maybe for you or I and other guys to think, well, he's enlightened, so whatever his sex life is like, that's something to aspire for, right, or aspire to, and I don't think he would want, you know, that.
I guess it would be interesting to see his viewpoint. I think sex is just that you have your natural urges, like getting hungry.
Yeah.
And he eats, right? So, I mean, if you're enlightened, you're going to eat. So you're probably still going to want to have sex. But there's probably other things. You don't have to be, like, abnormally sexual. That probably isn't there. It's probably more of a more natural state, as you said. I don't know. I didn't really think too much about, like, what do you think he would talk about? Frequency or the importance? I mean, he's talked about it a little bit, like how we can bring a couple together and whatnot.
Yeah. I mean, for example, well, I mean, big question, what's sex for once it's not procreative? I mean, that's obviously a big subject, and that can get into quite abstract and esoteric, which it probably would. But specifics, ejaculation, does he ejaculate? If not, why not? If so, you know, is there an energy loss and so on? Mm-hmm. I think we know there's an energy loss, but because my relationship with Dave, or my interactions with Dave, at least one-to-one level from the beginning to the present, my last one-to-one, have centered around my sexuality, my sex drive, whether I'm getting it, whether I'm not, why I'm not, what to do with the desire when it's not being satisfied, and so on. And in the early days of consulting with Dave, when, as I say, I was in the worst period in my marriage, where there was no sex and there was no possibility of sex, and I was really feeling triggered the whole time, Dave was kind of encouraging me to say, well, no, you're married, you should be having sex. And so after every one-to-one with Dave, I'd go to my wife and I'd be more insistent than ever, kind of thing. And she would know to say, she would know to expect that after I spoke to Dave. And but then, you know, things have obviously changed and evolved over the years, and including around this. And certainly in the last year or so, I've noticed him talking generally, if not specifically with me, more leaning more towards abstinence, not mm-hmm. actual celibacy, but definitely leaning more towards that. And so I do, I mean, for sure there's there are different things that motivate us to have sex, and without, it goes without saying that not all of them, or perhaps not even most of them, are particularly healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But there is the biological thing, as you say, it's more for men than women after a certain age, the need for biological release. There's the desire for intimacy and bonding, which seems healthy and natural as well. And then there's this mysterious energetic thing of exchanging information, perhaps, or I don't quite know how to talk about that. The thing that's been marketed in the West as Tantra, even though I don't suppose that really is it, if you know what I mean, because once it's been branded and packaged, it's probably counterfeit. But I think there is a, you know, there's something there that the word Tantra once did refer to, which is some transcendental function that sex has.
Mm-hmm. So abstinence, what would be the reason, Dave, would think? Is it just as we get older, we become more, less self-centered?
So you don't remember hearing him hint anything like that? I mean, not abstinence is putting it too strongly, but...
Well, he did say you should be able to, like, get naked with a woman and not have sex and just share.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to, like, it's kind of expected once you get to that point, right, that you're going to have it. But it shouldn't be expected. It should just be, I don't know if he put optional. I'm sure he didn't say optional, but
I think that's,
you should
be
able to be intimate without it, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the context, because he's been talking a lot about sex recently in its neurotic guises, essentially. And so that's mm-hmm. me, although it's not prescribing abstinence by any means, but it's definitely encouraging questioning and doubt around one's desire or urgency or imperative to have sex. And that did coincide in my own life, where I really, really just did hit me in the last few months that, you know, why do I want to have sex all the time? Because, you know, once it's over, it just comes back again. It is like eating in that regard, but I know I don't die if I don't have sex. So it's not primarily a biological urge anymore. So then why, you know, so I started to wonder, really, well, why? What's it for?
Would your relationship change with your wife if you didn't?
Well, we don't most of the time. I mean, I don't know what the longest period has been, but certainly this recent period is one of the longest, and that was February through to June. So that was whatever that is. It's only 4 months, I guess. I don't know what it's like for married listeners out there, but it's definitely been longer. It's been over a year, I think, in the worst period. Of course the relationship changes, but a big part of it has to do with these expectations. Like, I've got this idea that a marriage, to be good and loving and functioning and fulfilling, has got to have the sexual element. And that's almost separate from the, you know, the sperm in the testes constantly saying, let us out, you know, the hormonal drive. Mm-hmm. Is just what it is. I can add stuff onto that, and one of the things I can add onto it is this story that, well, if we're not having sex, it's not a real marriage kind of thing.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's more like friendship or roommates, except that, you know, without the freedom. Your roommates, yeah. Without the freedom.
Yeah, or to put a positive spin on it, it's more like spiritual allies or cohorts, like we're working, or collaborators. My wife and I collaborate a lot. So there's no doubt. I mean, I've never felt that our marriage just became friendship or roommate. It either became enemies and really mm-hmm. horrible, or it's become... We've become more aware of how we work together and even create together in ways that don't center around the sexual mm-hmm. the sexual act. We are a creative couple, and I think that we merge, and you know, we connect at deeper levels, and this is how I would sum up my intuitive sense of what Dave's talking about, because of having, not necessarily put it into practice, but having experienced things that seem to be running parallel with what he's talking about, that the cup, before the cup can be filled, it has to be emptied. So if I want to continue to go deeper with my wife, including sexually, then at a certain point I've got to stop being satisfied with the shallow or with familiar or routinary forms of sexual interaction, which we know how to do, we know the doing of, but they're just kind of, they are a bit like eating in that sense. We're just, okay, well, a bit hungry now, mm-hmm. let's just throw something together, honey, and wolf it down, you know, and then we'll feel better afterwards, kind of thing. Well, that actually closes down a space for something entirely new to happen, and that's what I want much more. And it's back to this much larger question, isn't it? Is, you know, what are we really seeking in this life, and how much are we willing to sacrifice to achieve it?
And that's a balance again between merging versus individual growth. That's another thing that is a concept in my mind that I'm a little bit confused, or not confused, but I just keep, you know, the conflict between, because Dave talks about merging a lot mm-hmm. as people, but then also if you're a soul that goes through multiple lifetimes, and the reason you're doing that is to basically grow up as one entity, one individual entity. I guess you come to a point where merging is good, but then you may go beyond that point where it hampers your development. It's like being part of a team. You learn how to cooperate and work with other people. But then once the roles are established and you become good at that, you where do you go from there? You're just kind of stuck, you know, doing the same part at that point. And especially once the team starts going in a direction that maybe you don't agree with, then you have to kind of unmerge. Mm. And well, so I think there's no one like climbing a mountain. I think it's an adventure. It's one adventure to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. And then, you know, as you're doing this, you kind of grow. So I'm not saying marriage is like you're stuck with it, and maybe at one point it's better to get divorced and go off on your own. But for some people, it probably is if they're not matching up well. But then for others, to have a partner for life, I guess, is a, you know, it might be part of the growth as well. I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, nothing fits a blueprint. You know, everything is so.
Well, not. Individual. I mean, there might be sort of yin yang principles, and actually, that image fits with what was coming to mind, also, which is this Cahill Gibran thing. I think it was that famous book that everybody had, whatever it was called. Let there be spaces in your togetherness. That seems as though. And that's in the yin-yang, essentially. It's not exactly that, but there's the black in the white and the white in the black. So they exist separately, but they're also, they create one whole. I think that's the optimal situation, isn't it? That's the optimal marital setup, I think, is that there's a consistent kind of experience of togetherness, but there are spaces in it, and the spaces intensify the togetherness. And vice versa, the togetherness allows us to move into new spaces, including spaces of aloneness. We do it alone, and so you could say we go off alone and then we come back together. But you could also say that over time, we are fusing in some way, and I'd say this could apply to a team as well, or a group, so that we become more and more able to move freely and autonomously and separately without losing the sense of being connected.
Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of trust on everybody's part.
Yes.
If there's just two of you, you have to have your own self-reliance that you don't need the other person all the time. You don't need the other person constantly confirming to you, you know, that, hey, you know, I still care about you, even though I'm not, like, you know, I'm spending a little more time by myself than I used to. It doesn't mean anything. It's a tough balance, you know. Nobody said life is supposed to be easy.
I just went through this, actually, but I'm probably too fresh to talk about it, but around this four-day intensive, because my wife participated in it and I didn't, because I chose to run the thrift store, somebody had to.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I was there, like I was, because it was happening in the house, right? She was attending it online in the house, and I was in the house a lot of the time. So, and at these other levels as well, I felt like I was there in the field, but I wasn't actually there. I didn't know what was going on, and it was quite disorienting and strange, and I was divided. I did feel a bit abandoned that she was off with my people and I wasn't there, and but I also felt it was an opportunity for me to explore my own separation while being connected. That, and what just what you were saying, like, well, I don't actually need to be there and having it confirmed and validated that I'm part of this, because I am, but I'm also, what I'm part of is much greater, and that the only connection that I can't live without is the connection to the source, to the spirit. And I think, I mean, it's essential to remember that, because, couples who try to use each other to get what they want, and they don't maintain and develop and deepen their connection to the source, they do end up squeezing the life out of their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very necessary for me, and it's necessary in any marriage, but I also think it's necessary in what Dave's doing, is that we look to each other and we gaze at each other literally, and we connect and we feel deepening connections and intimacy, but we also, you know, look away and move into our own lives, mm-hmm. independently of that, and that the two things grow together. That is trust. I mean, it's a transcendental kind of trust, because it's not trusting that these people will be nice to us or tell us what we want to hear. It's trusting in something transcendental, that we actually have these deeper energetic connections that nothing can destroy.
Mm-hmm. You're lucky your wife works with you for your business. I don't know if that's lucky, but and she's also involved with Dave's thing going on.
And we
so you don't have that. You don't have a I don't know. I mean, it seems like I could see how that could bring you together, you know, to work on something together like that versus with my situation. I'm kind of on my own, both for my job and my practice here and with Dave, although my wife's becoming a little bit more involved in my practice. And so in that regard, there's no feedback between her and I. If I change too much, if I grow too much, and she's changing in her own way, but if we're not on the same direction, the same path, there's going to be too much separation there. And but yet we still meet, you know, somewhere in the middle. I mean, we can put that aside, but and because of the children we have and in our life, we have that in common still.
Has she noticed any changes though, since you've been from participating with Dave?
I think maybe. I mean, I'm definitely like, especially right after the Sundays, during the Sundays, even that day or so afterwards, I'm usually much more calm and much more, you know, looking for the right word here. Not hippie like, but I made comments to her about, and I probably maybe more than I should. Like, I noticed things about her afterwards where she's more uptight than she needs to be about certain situations, that she's a little more judgmental than she needs to be about going through life. And, you know, if I mention that, then she'll say, "Oh, is that what your guru taught you?" or something like that.
Right.
So in that regard, she notices or at least makes comments there. But I don't know if she's seen like a big change on me, because she's gone through such a big change in her own life over the last year that she's probably not in a stable position where she can look around and see what's going around, you know, with others beside her. She's very has been very focused on herself, which in a good way though, not a bad way. And so maybe at some point she'll notice a difference. I don't think for me it's been a huge change though. I mean, it's all internal, but as a guy, I don't really, you know, express I do express myself quite a bit at home, but in a certain kind of way, and I don't think I've changed that much on how I express what's going on inside me, but where other people would notice so much. And that's what I had a one-on-one with Dave, I don't know, maybe three months ago or so. And this was, I had taken a big break from him, and I hadn't seen him in about 6 months, and he said, "Oh, so you know, a lot of big changes in you, huh? You've been coming along." And I was like, "I guess so." And then I said, I don't really notice a big change, you know, subtle changes. But if you see, you know, an animal growing from a puppy to a dog, you don't notice it on a day-to-day basis until you look back on it. And I don't have, you don't have snapshots of your inner self. You don't, you can't take a look at a photograph of your inner self and how you were a year ago. So it's hard to compare, qualities. So, but I mean, for me, I just, it's not so much, I don't care too much about what other people think. It's just, if it's right for me, then I'm going to keep doing it. So, and I wanted to ask you, you know, you were talking to me about how I feel the bliss, what I call the bliss. I don't know if it's the same thing, but what do you feel physically? Like, you must feel, is it easy for you to, could you explain it? Like, you must feel something, even if it took you a while to feel it. What kind of sensations do you feel like just sitting around?
Well, less and less actually, and I think it's because it's becoming more and more integrated in my life. So now I'm just more aware of being more easily putting my attention on my body, and that being a pleasant thing to just put my attention on my body, and that there's a signal of well-being there, which is no longer even a sensation, but it did start as a sensation when I was first noticing it on the retreats, and after the retreats it was a tangible sensation, so I could even say, oh, I've lost it now, or oh, it's come back again. Not a vibration, but really, really hard to describe, but sort of like a sweet hum that is a flat plane, and like my whole awareness is on this flat horizontal plane. And even now, it's like my body extends outward to left and right. For some reason, I don't really experience it up and down so much, or I don't think of it that way. And it's supporting me. So I know now. I notice not so much if a feeling or a sensation is gone, just that I'm starting to feel, miserable and frustrated and dissatisfied again. And so it seems as though it's just become more of a less of a thing, less of an actual thing that's separate from my life and my being and my body, but it's still something that, I've learned to refer to as often as possible. Like, not it's not is it there, but just is my attention where it needs to be and where it wants to be as well. So not even a discipline, but like, oh, don't forget to relax. Don't forget to enjoy being here. Enjoy the physical act of being here. Yeah, I mean, it's very vague, isn't it? It's probably not a very satisfying answer, but I think that's the nature of it, isn't it? It's the ineffable. And I think that it's better that it becomes less and less susceptible to bigging up in the mind and turning into some, brand or some story, and just becomes more and more observable, I think, in my life and even in the world around me. And it's like it's spilling out, like the honey is pouring in and spilling out into my life and affecting others. And it's less and less about me actually getting something or feeling something for myself. Maybe that sounds a bit noble. A bit selfless, I'm not claiming that, but I do think there's that trajectory that I'm noticing.
Do other people affect it? I mean, you can tell because Dave talks about picking up other people's, I don't want to say thoughts, but I guess energy, maybe emotions. Is that something that you're able to pick up on or even transmit? Like if somebody came in a, let's say, a frustrated or fearful state, maybe even a little bit angry, you would be able to just, calm them down a little bit.
Well, that's working in the thrift store on a daily basis.
Yeah,
That's
that's what I was.
a job requirement. And that's a great example of something that I'm learning entirely independently of Dave. But it's rubber meeting road. I can test what Dave's talking about and whether I'm really absorbing it and applying it. I've got this field testing opportunity on a daily basis.
I find when I'm like interacting with people, my mind is just takes over. I'm not aware of really much of anything. Just when
Yeah.
I'm listening, like even talking to you, when I talk, I'm talking. And then when I'm listening, that's when I start to become aware of stuff.
Yeah, that's that yin yang thing and the trickiness of actually not filling the space before it's necessary, so that something in us comes up spontaneously. I think being being receptive. It's hard because, like, even that pause there, if I pause too long, I'll lose the thread and I won't actually be able to continue talking. Well, that's just something with time. I mean, you just actually started with Dave, so if there's, you know, if there are any changes at all in less than a year, I think that's quite significant.
He seems to be on a quick timeline when he was talking. Things that he's trying to rush things, you know. Maybe he had more patience in the past.
Time seems is running like out. That's his motto.
Yeah, as he keeps saying, right?
Yeah.
I don't know what that means, though.
He's been saying it for 20 years, but now he's saying it like he means it. Now he's feeling it. That's the end of my conversation with JC or Jason Carter. Next week's podcast is with Hermetics. All the time, changes in the heart change with the time. Strangers in the night change with the time. Dangers in the dark clouds up and downtown. Changes in your soul, they happen all the time. Strangers in the dark change with the times. The little sins, all the letdowns and wins, the things you begin with, the things that you end with, the changes in the heart change with the times. Changes in the heart change with the time. Strangers in the night pass up and downtown. Changes in your soul. Stay up until light. Dangers in your soul, they motion to the sky.